We saw a really interesting accident.
Oh. So somebody hit a house on the freeway.
You mean like a mobile home was being dragged down the freeway?
Pretty close. Uh-oh. You know, they prefabricate houses and they'll ship them in two halves?
Right.
One of those. A truck, a big truck, hit one of those trying to pass it.
Trying to pass a house on the freeway. I was driving by your house when I hit it.
It's absurd as it sounds.
What have I got in my joke book?
I do like the quote, asked whether he was imposing his own vegan diet on those his charity served, Mr. Simon said, they can eat all the meat they want. I'm just not going to pay for it.
Okay, ready?
Done reading. Everybody's done reading. Count it down.
5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
This is Michael Bloom from the APS Stamp Buddy Service Committee, welcoming you to Stamp Show here today.
Return to sender. Return to sender.
Welcome to Stamp Show here today, podcast number 23. I'm sitting here with Scott, Kaz, Jeff, and I'm your host, Jessica. You can find us on Facebook at Stamp Show Here Today and on Twitter at Stamp Show HT. Tell your friends they can find us on iTunes, Podbay, and Stitcher. Let's talk about stamps. So this week we'll be talking about stamp news, new postmaster, hashtag stamp stories, Sam Simon, and our expert topic of the week is Kansas-Nebraska overprints. Stamp news, Megan J. Brennan was sworn in as the nation's 74th Postmaster General on March 6. She is the first female postal chief. So I guess they had to turn it over to the women because the men weren't doing such a great job.
Uh-oh. Well, I mean, you have guys like Farley, you know.
He was great. He made some fun stuff.
Well, he made good stamps, but then he kept giving them away to people.
There's been 74 postmasters. They should make like a sheet of each postmaster. 74 stamps. A 74 stamp set.
And everybody would care this much.
Well, then all the little kids in school could memorize the postmasters along with the presidents.
Oh, bother.
So do we have as many postmasters as we've had presidents?
Oh, yeah.
Way more.
Way more. By
way more.
20-something at least.
We're on
40-something, yeah.
Well, it depends on who you call the first president, too.
Yeah.
Well, there's George Washington, or there's Peyton Randolph. Peyton Randolph was the first president of the Continental Congress.
Oh.
John Hancock was the first president of a place called the United States.
Hmm.
George Washington is the first president under the new Constitution.
Okay, so moving back to the article.
I brought that to a screeching halt, didn't I?
She wants to bring new technology to move the mail to probably save money, because apparently we're not so doing so good with that their mail delivery.
I think that has a lot to do with the public unions who are demanding these huge-ass pensions.
Well, that and, you know, email.
And contractual stipulations that they can't fire anybody.
Yeah.
What?
Well, I think that it's sort of the same thing as, you know, the Army went through with artillery. You know, for a very, very long time, they had 5 people on an artillery crew. And the 5th person was traditional because he was the one who held the horses. And when they stopped having horses, they still had the 5th guy there just in case somebody got shot or something.
Or a horse showed up.
Later on, they said, okay, 4. Well, I mean, the post office has the same thing. They have many people who do jobs that could very easily be replaced with mechanization now. But then the people lose their jobs. So it's a question of, do you want faster, cheaper mail? Or do you want more people hired in a lower unemployment rate?
Well, some of that's human conditioning, though, too, because I know at our big postal hub in Redlands, we have an automated machine, a great big gigantic monstrosity that pretty much does everything a counter person does, probably with less attitude.
They but, even hired someone to stand in line and be like, what are you doing? Why didn't you see the clerk?
Yeah.
Go to that machine over there. It can do the same thing.
You know, rush hour? The machine will have 2 people in line, and there'll be 30 waiting for a clerk.
Well, it's like at Home Depot. You know, now you have your self-checkout.
Yeah, the automatic lane.
Yeah.
So, anything they can do to reduce overhead. But the government's not run like that. The government is – the unions pressure the government into these ridiculous contracts requiring ridiculous amounts of pension money and clauses like you can't fire me. And they shouldn't be allowed to do that. This is the government. This is our tax money. This is not a private corporation making $3 billion a year.
Well, actually, I think it is, isn't it? They don't get tax money, do they? Do they get subsidies or anything? I know everything has to go through the Congress and everything, but I don't think they actually take
tax dollars. Well, they're a quasi-government.
Right.
They're owned by the government, but they're supposed to run independently of tax money.
Right. So the whole idea is that they need to break even, and what I saw...
But they're not breaking even.
Yeah, but like 3 years ago was last time. I don't keep up on this stuff, but I remember 3 years ago, they made their books so that they broke even. But everybody said, yeah, but your books are showing your number of letters going up when we know that they're going down. We know that you're going to be doing less volume, yet you show in your projections you're doing more. So you break even on paper, but in reality, then, you know, they hit their whatever $3 or $4 billion loss, you know.
They're cooking their books.
Yeah.
I want to close with a quote. She said, "They will enable the Postal Service to revitalize how we engage the American public and fulfill our public service mission." So she has a very positive outlook on the future of the Postal Service. So hopefully she can make it happen.
Well, I think that statement doesn't mean anything when you convert it to actual English. I would have loved her to say, we are going to convert to new technology to increase income so that we can satisfy our monetary debts. And if she would have said that, then everybody would have said, whoa, yeah. But that's sort of, you know, we're looking forward into the future. And like I tell everybody, whenever somebody talks about whenever somebody uses the word future in something, they have no clue what they're talking about, because otherwise they'd be specific.
You have no future in this business.
Exactly. I doubt the post office will ever hire me for anything.
Well, Jessica had a fun experience at the post office. Give me an idea why their numbers are dwindling. Could you describe the person that was in front of you in line at the post office?
She was there just to complain about a letter she got in the mail.
Wait. How old was she?
80-ish.
She was there to demand to see the postmaster because there was a problem with a letter that she received that she thought, what was it? She thought it was like
she said she was being scammed or something like that. And I'm like, well, that's kind of a police thing. They don't really read all your mail to make sure it's legitimate.
She wanted the postmaster to tell her if it was a scam or not.
I'll give you a hint, everybody out there who's listening. If somebody asks you for money and then you send it, you've been scammed. If somebody like gives you an actual service or like pipes water to your house or something and then asks for money, you're not being scammed.
Good call.
Or if you have to pay money to get more money, that's a scam.
That's the best one.
Yeah.
I've been contacted by quite a few Nigerian princes, actually, on that route.
I got one just a little while ago, and it said, you know, something about importing in millions of dollars and stuff. And I wrote back just facetiously, and I said, wow, that sounds great. I haven't got two nickels to rub together most of the time. Anything I can do to help, though, please give me an email. And he wrote back and said, sorry, it takes a financial commitment.
So this week in stamp collecting history, in 1912, the Girl Guides, now known as the Girl Scouts, forms in Savannah by Juliet Gordon Lowe. So they also encourage stamp collecting, I believe, still, and for badges and
mother. I know the
merit
Boy badges. Scouts.
Boy
do.
Scouts does. Yeah. Does the Girl Scouts have a stamp collecting badge?
I believe it's just a collecting badge in general.
Oh, okay.
They sure do have a weird commemorative stamp, though.
Well, it's of her, isn't
what?
It?
Julia Gordon Lowe?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She's the artwork. And I thought they did stamp collecting because I bought a little mailbox Chotsky and it had a bunch of airmails in it. Printed on it, not in it.
It was this little Girl Scout collectible. It looked like a wall-mounted mailbox. and it had information about Juliet Lowe on the back, on the metal, and it was made to look old, but it wasn't. It was all in the printing that was on it, and you open it up, and there's a stack of mail printed inside, and it's all air mails and like Zeppelins and stuff. It was really cool.
Wow. That should do very, very well on a non-visual podcast.
Exactly.
sounds exactly like a tchotchke.
Yeah.
Doesn't it, though?
I mean, some useless thing that's going to sit on the shelf for whatever reason.
Exactly.
Whatever it looks like.
Okay, so this week in stamp stories. So Jeff said, what do you say, things happen in threes?
Mm-hmm.
So we lost Leonard Nimoy. So this week, unfortunately, we've lost a man named Sam Simon. And if you don't know him by name, you know The Simpsons. He was part one of the great minds behind that cartoon, and he passed away from colon cancer at the age of 59. His most notable character creation was Mr. Burns.
Excellent.
He's also known for participating in the Sea Shepherd Society, which is opposed to whale hunting, and actually has a boat named after him. And he also runs a food bank for low-income families with free vegan meals.
Not anymore.
Yeah. Well, he put a lot of money into it. A lot of money.
Well, yeah.
There might be a foundation there somewhere.
Yeah, vegan if you know, he's not going to hunt any whales. Take the whale meat off the menu, and all of a sudden, there goes all your food.
Then he just can't put whale oil in his lamps.
There you go.
So if you think he should get a stamp, we're going to use the hashtag stampworthy again, hashtag stamp stories. And I also saw that they've done a Simpson stamp in the past for 44 cent U.S., stamp, which lost the Postal Service a lot of money, but I think this one will do better.
Well, it lost the Postal Service a lot of money because they had to pay copyright and royalties.
And printing and storage and everything else, yeah.
Yeah, and a lot of old people didn't like The Simpsons on stamps, so.
Do.
He knew that.
I knew I could count on somebody for that sound effect.
They would have done much better on the Simpsons stamp if they had it in a format like the other ones, where it was a mini sheet with a side salvage of like a picture. Then people would collect the sheet. But as it was, it's kind of an uncreative looking little. You know, it's got all the characters, but it doesn't stand out.
I could see a really cool one where it's like a Granada sheet.
Yeah.
Where the center punch-out stamp is them sitting on their couch, and then the rest of it is the frame of the living room.
Oh, that would be great, yeah. Or like the Civil War, where you have something on the front, and then on the back, you have a special, you know, you have something like that, them sitting on the couch.
Mm-hmm.
And then the stamp with the faces, you pull off like a little mini souvenir sheet or something.
So you hear that, Postal Service?
Give us more Simpsons stamps.
More cool stamps.
Get creative.
Yeah.
Oh, they do. When they do good stuff, they do really good stuff. But when they do bad stuff, it's a joke.
I think the new Civil War.
The Civil War series is fantastic.
I like the 1812.
Yeah.
War of 1812 series a lot better than the Civil War series, actually.
I like the format and the look of the Civil War series. Let's see, what else did they come out with lately that has looked good?
I liked the artwork on the Pan American reissue sheet.
Yeah, that was cool. Except everybody complained about the little things on the side.
The 90-cent Buffalo stamps.
I got one of those, and I didn't even realize those were stamps at first.
Well, the best sheet, the Batman stamp.
It was to pump up the value.
Yeah, otherwise it's a 6-cent sheet, right? 7-cent sheet.
Okay, updates. We're going to start with Cash's corrections.
Well, this is an old correction from a ways ago. We were talking about Zheng He, the Chinese explorer. We were talking about Zheng He, Ohio, instead of Columbus, Ohio.
Oh, yeah.
The actual pronunciation of his name, even though it's spelled Zheng He, is actually Zheng Ha. So we shouldn't insult people by calling them by the wrong name, especially when they're eunuchs and dead for several hundred years.
Yep.
Second thing is I want to remind everybody that Paul McCartney, this is the anniversary of him being knighted. which makes him my favorite, my second favorite knight behind Knight Rider.
Wow.
But bum.
Okay, so our listener questions. We actually had a listener post an article to our Facebook describing the giant leftover cement arrows that can be found across the U.S. to help direct airmail planes. So to add to our airmail episode, I found beautiful pictures of these. I don't know, would you call them ruins?
Modern ruins. Yeah.
At sometimesinteresting.com. There's a dash between the words sometimes and interesting. And the article's called Concrete Arrows and the U.S. Airmail Beacon System. So it was before GPS, so that was state of the art back then.
That was also when they could, when they weren't flying so high up that they could still see the ground.
They had to maintain a low altitude.
Something less than, what, 10,000 feet?
Well, something less than they needed an oxygen supply because they didn't have any.
That's true. That, too.
You're in an open
open pressure system, yeah.
Cockpit. I mean, forget about the air pressure. It's just probably cold up there.
Oh, yeah. Hey, was that why bomber jackets were so thick for so long? Better insulation?
I thought that was to protect them from bombs.
Yeah.
A little bit of both.
They had no heat up there.
That's only if they try to drop them when they're upside down, I thought.
Oh, okay.
Our expert topic of the week is inspired by Lynn's article by John N. Hotchner, and it's on Kansas-Nebraska overprints of 1929, expertizing them. So, for those of you that don't know, stamps overprinted Kansas and Nebraska were issued in 1929 with 11 stamps in each set. These denominations range from 1 cent to 10 cent, including a 1.5 cent stamp in each set. They're created because apparently there was a string of post office robberies, and it was to prevent them from being used in other states. So it was like a test run to see if this would be good anti-theft
measure.
Yeah, anti-theft, anti...
Well, not so much anti-theft, but it would hamper the resale of items that were stolen. So it basically took away the incentive for, or the ability for the thieves to sell their stolen merchandise.
Their ill-gotten gains.
So
it's part of the Westerns they left out, you know, when they go rob a bank. Well, apparently post offices were even easier than that. So we need to see a Western on that.
I have always questioned this because it doesn't strike me as really a fully thought out idea, because if you steal stamps in, let's say, Springfield, Missouri, it prevents you from selling them in Las Vegas, Nevada, but it doesn't prevent you from selling them in like Shelbyville, Missouri.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it doesn't strike me that, I mean, I could see why the experiments failed. These states are big.
I was going to say that unless you're in Rhode Island, a state is a pretty big place.
I'll bet you even in Rhode Island, you can, you know, move across some city limit and sell the stamp someplace else.
Yeah, they have counties. I mean.
But news does travel, and the post office actually put out announcements that stamps have been stolen, but why would a postmaster be buying stamps from anybody but the government anyway?
I don't think it's the postmasters who.
Well, it would be businesses.
Yeah,
and so, I mean, as long as it's advertised in the newspapers, I'm sure most businessmen knew about it.
Well, we have a fairly thriving secondhand stamp market today. That, you know, if...
Yeah, but those aren't stolen stamps.
Yeah,
that's just
a whole different reason.
They're
still ill-gotten sometimes.
I have seen stamps that were stolen, and the person, they were booklet panes. And the person had pulled the lower, I forget whether it was left or right side, it was a long time ago. They pulled the lower right or lower left stamp out because it had a plate number on it. And they thought that the booklet pane could be tracked by the plate number. So we saw, you know, maybe like 100 booklets or more, 200 booklets. All of them had the lower left stamp cut out of it.
Oh, boy.
I mean, obviously, the person didn't realize, no, that's a plate number, not a...
Serial number.
Serial number. But If the post office was trying to just remove the secondary market for stamps, I still think that there's a better way than, you know, overprinting every stamp, you know, Kansas and Nebraska.
So the stamps that were used are actually pretty common, the base stamp without the overprint.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they're getting less and less common, but yeah, there are still a lot of them out there.
What's the nickname for that series? No Scott numbers?
The Kansas and Nebraskas?
No, the base stamps that they came from.
Oh. The Rotary Press 4th Bureau issue?
4th Bureau, that's it. That's what I thought. Yeah, they used Scott 658 to 668 and 669 to 679 for these.
I always remember the issue because there's two valuable ones, and one of them, the most valuable one, is 666.
Oh, the devil's overprint. Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that's always funny when I get one of those.
So these are printed on a rotary press. So what would that look like as far as the gum goes?
Well, maybe a little bit of blurb here about how they're produced. The paper is put on a press. And you got a great big roll of paper. And the paper is drawn through a trough of water to dampen the paper. Then it goes through and the stamp is printed by the curved printing plates, and then it goes through an ink drying section, and then over to another section where the electrotype plates are print the overprint. Then it's gummed. Then it goes through a gum drying box where it dries the gum and the overprint, and then it goes through a perforating step, and then it's rolled again onto another roll, and then when the roll is big enough, they take it and they cut it into sheets.
Important thing there is the order.
Right. The important thing is the stamp is printed and the overprinter printed before the stamp is gummed. Okay, that's very important, because then when the stamp is gummed, there's no impression of the overprint or the stamp image on the gum. And all the stages go through a drying box so that there is no ink on the back of the paper when the gum is soaked off. And there can be, if it doesn't completely dry, you might get a little bit on, if the stamp has gum on it, it might be on top of the gum, but it's not going to be under the gum like it would be on a flat plate printed stamp. So those are all important factors in how it was made. And it's very difficult to fake a Kansas Nebraska overprint on a mint stamp. Much easier to fake it on a used stamp, because a mint stamp is going to have that gum, and you're going to be able to, there's different conditions. They used gum breakers so that the sheets of stamps wouldn't curl when they got to the post offices, and they're sitting in the drawers and different humidities throughout the country. So they had gum breakers to kind of help the sheets lay flat. And at different times, they used a different spacing on the gum breakers. Three in particular, and Kansas Nebraska overprints were printed in such a short time frame that only one gum breaker type can exist on the Kansas Nebraskas for them to be genuine. So a lot of times the fakers would not pay didn't know this, so they didn't pay attention to what their base material was, and they'd use flat plate printed stamps. They'd use rotary press printed stamps with the wrong gum breakers. These are all reasons why it's difficult to fake a mint Kansas Nebraska stamp if you know what you're looking at.
Well, also, you know, the value of the stamps increased over time, and this issue was sold, I believe, up until the 1930s. So in the late 1920s, early 1930s, they just went down to the post office and said, hey, I want to make a bunch of 8-cent Kansas. They'd buy a sheet of 8-cent Kansas stamps that were still at the post office. The problem is they were not in the early 1920s 8-cent stamps. They were the late 1930s or late 1920s, early 1930s.
They only overprinted, the Kansas Nebraskas were only overprinted.
But I'm talking about the stock that the fakers got.
Yes, the stock.
They'd buy the stock from the post office.
Right. The stock was printed over a very long period of time. And as a matter of fact, even the color shade of the stamp can make a difference, because these stamps were basically printed all in a very short period of time. And many of the stamps have huge, huge color variations throughout their fairly long life. And you can identify Kansas, Nebraska fakes simply by them being on the wrong shade of stamp, because it could never have been genuinely printed there. So that's also very important. And when you get...
Well, the reason why they're rare too is because they were printed in 1929. In 1929, there were some, let's say, economic issues going in where people were not buying bunches of stamps. You know, it was the recession hit later that year, and people were not putting these stamps aside. That's why they're scarce, or scarcer. Because they were released into Washington, D.C. Any stamp collector could have bought them from the post office fulfillment house in Washington, D.C.
Well, yeah, even after the test period, when they determined that this test was
stupid,
dumb, not going to work, they weren't going to continue it, they weren't going to make it go nationwide, at that point, you could use Kansas, Nebraska stamps in any state. They were valid for postage. Actually, they were valid for postage at any time in any state. That was just where you bought them that they had to be overprinted. So,
yeah, that's a good point. I wonder.
I mean, you could buy it in Kansas and take it over to Iowa and mail a letter, and it was still valid for postage.
Well, then what was there? I mean, the article doesn't go too much into it. I always thought that it was, well, if you have Nebraska stamps in Kansas and Kansas stamps in Nebraska, you know that they came there through illicit means. But if you could buy the stamps in Kansas and use them anywhere, how is that supposed to stop anybody from stealing them?
Well, that was one of the things that the article said was actually a problem, is that it made it hard. It didn't prove anything. How would that have related all to buying a stamp legitimately in one state and then using it in another? It doesn't help.
Well, another reason it failed is because it was a black overprint, and there was a black 7-cent stamp that the overprint did not show up very well on. It kind of just disappeared. Oh, yeah.
You know what they should
ink.
Have done? They should have overprinted the stamps. Please don't steal me. And that would have kept the robbers from stealing them.
We know that works in any other program that the government uses that with.
There you go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's illegal. Don't do it. That always works, right?
Yep. That's why there's no more gun crime here.
There you go. Well, you brought up that they were black. My favorite way to collect Kansas, Nebraskas is to get them with a Kansas or a Nebraska pre-cancel. And Hastings is the most common Kansas one. But I still don't have a complete set of them. But you can get Hastings, Kansas, and then the little word Kansas underneath it. It gives it a very odd, interesting little look, because they're almost sort of in the same type font. The pre-cancel is just a little bit bigger, so it looks like it's Hastings, Kansas, Kansas.
It's Hastings, Nebraska, by the way.
Oh, now Hastings, Nebraska, Nebraska. Thank you. Now I don't have to do a cash correction next week.
That was a bonus cash correction where cash got corrected during the podcast.
Live.
Well, what's the common Kansas one then?
Kansas City.
Kansas City, Kansas? Okay. Kansas City, Missouri. Where's the other Kansas City?
Missouri,
yeah. Okay.
That's just confusing.
Well, I was watching how the states got their shapes. Mm. Great show, by the way. Anybody out there, do a search on it.
There's also a note in here, you mentioned shades. One of the shades that was brought up was the 8-cent olive green is genuine, but there's also an olive blister.
Bister.
Oh.
No L.
And that's the number 666 Devil's stamp.
Oh.
That's if it's Kansas. If it's Nebraska, it's...
It's the
677.
11, seven, yeah, 11, 11 numbers later.
677.
Yeah.
And if you buy a plate block, Derlin actually has a pretty good list of all the plate blocks that were used to make these. There's only a couple.
Yeah, I think the example that John Hotchner used in his article was that there are only, I think it said 9 plates for the 2 cent, and there were more than 250 plates used for the unoverprinted 2 cent. So obviously by plate number you can weed that down quite a bit too.
Just wonder if they had wonder if like they said, it doesn't appear that this is working, but it might be that we just don't have it nationally done. And wonder if they issued a stamp overprinted issue for every state. You would have 550.
Oh my God. More.
Well, how many states were there in 1929?
48.
Okay. You would have, what's my math?
502.
502 more stamps. For just that issue, and then no, if they did it with other issues.
You have to subtract the 22.
Gosh. I,
dear God.
I went to public school.
Yes, he did.
But it would be very interesting, you know, if every single issue had these overprints. I think everybody would just ignore the overprints.
Well, I think my favorite fake that I've run across, I found some fake Kansas-Nebraska overprinted Prexies.
Oh, cool.
What?
Yes. They, completely
somebody
wrong
just issue. Got bored.
Completely wrong issue. But totally seriously, somebody at my stamp club brought them to me and asked me, I can't find these in the catalog. Can you help me find them?
Please tell me they were done with like an inkjet printer or something.
No.
Oh.
Typewriter?
They actually looked halfway decent, but they were unused Prexy stamps.
Half of the Kansas Nebraskas I've seen, which are fake, were just done on the typewriter.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the one where, you know, if you see the punch mark coming through the gum on the other side.
Right. And if anybody's used an old style typewriter, you know exactly what that looks like. You have a fairly thin or soft paper, and you have a nice hard strike from a typewriter. It shows through on the back, embosses it.
Especially the period at the end.
Yes. Especially the period.
So then that would be a simplified rule. If it's legitimate, you should be able to see an indentation on the paper from the front on a mint stamp. But no. On the back, it shouldn't leave an indentation in the gum.
Actually, no. It doesn't leave an indentation anywhere.
You have to understand.
On the real ones.
You have to understand how electrotype works.
Okay. Go on.
Well, you barely know what a typewriter
you
is.
You get electricity. Okay.
I was born in 82. Forgive my ignorance.
You have a plate that has the lettering on it, and it's mm-hmm. raised lettering, and it's inked, and the paper goes across the image, and it prints just like it's not. They don't use pressure like they do with engraved printing, but it runs over it like typograph printing.
Typograph is different.
Typograph is different, yeah.
Right. Basically, what you have is you have a plate, and there's different ways to do it. It could be raised lettering, but it typically is not. Usually, it's printed with some sort of a chemical. And you have a roller roll over the top of it. It puts the ink on, then you have a paper that rolls over the top of it, and it takes the ink off. And I have no idea why they call it electrotype. Probably because electricity was a big, huge, fancy thing there, and they said, oh, it's electric or something. I mean, it has absolutely nothing to do with electricity. I mean, unless there's some Greek word for electro, which means, rubbing paper on metal.
I guess.
Yeah.
So then there should be no impression at all if it's legitimate. Okay. Fair enough. And I have seen them where it has left an impression then, so that makes sense.
Yep.
Therefore, those were not real.
Yep. I have a whole sheet of them I have to go look at now that had that Martha Washington.
Yeah, that was canal zone, though, I think.
Oh.
Yeah.
Does it different apply overprint. To those, too, or no?
Well, the other thing, too, yes. about this is they used the exact same machines that they put pre-cancels on the stamps. These overprints were actually printed with the same machinery that they used for pre-cancels. And also the same for Molly Pitcher, and the same for Hawaii. You know, all the United States is blessed that it doesn't have very many overprints. And
true.
How, with the exception, the and I'm fairly certain of this, but not 100%. I believe that the China overprints actually had plates. It wasn't electroplate printed. It was actual plates. Am I correct?
I believe it was typograph plates, yes.
Yeah, yeah. So, other than the China overprints, pretty much all the overprints from that time period were all done that way.
When did they stop overprinting stamps?
Yesterday.
Next week?
Yeah.
They still do that.
There are countries that still do. It's cheaper than reprinting when you need to change a value or do something different to a stamp.
Oh, which reminds me of a story about Chinese stamps. They did the same thing we did, except they did it for a different reason. During the Chinese, in the 1930s, they overprinted their stamps for, they didn't have states, they had provinces. They overprinted their stamps for provinces. They put the province names. And anybody who looks in a Scott catalog, you know, all of a sudden it's like their eyes glaze over because there's so many overprints
yeah.
in so many places. And you go, how do I know if this is a Hunan or the Sichuan or why? Well, the reason that they did it was China was going through a huge inflationary period. And in the end of the inflationary period, an 8-cent stamp turned into a $20 stamp. There were huge amounts of inflation. And the inflation wasn't equal across the country. Certain areas had higher inflation than others. Some areas had lower inflation. And the reason that they did it was not to prevent theft, but to prevent people from profiting off the different exchange rates. Because if you can buy a stamp in the Hopi province and sell it in the Sichuan province because their money is cheaper and put the money in your pocket, you'd be ripping off the post office. So China did the exact same thing that we did it, except that, again, they did it to prevent people from money, let's say currency manipulation, whereas we, and they were successful, whereas we did it to stop people from robbing the post office, and we were terribly unsuccessful.
Shoot, we just call that capitalism over here.
Yeah.
That's normal for us.
Yeah. I'd love to go to D.C. and buy gas for $2 a gallon, but alas, I cannot make it over there.
Yeah, that's quite a drive.
Buy it and sell it here and still make a profit.
Oh, no, no. Well, in Northern California, you have people filling up their tanks in Oregon and driving back. It happens
really?
All the time.
Huh.
Oh, yeah.
That's
and also
funny.
Buying cars. Well, especially now in California, we have like the most expensive gas in the country right now because we're paying for a bullet train and we're paying for a bunch of extra taxes. And I mean, people, if you want to, if you buy gas someplace, bring it to California and sell it, you'll make money.
Hmm. Oh, California has a special air quote summer blend too.
Oh.
We get to pay for that coming up.
Yeah, they charge more for that too.
Yeah. Yep. Ooh. Well, you'd expect something like that. You know, bikini season comes on, and, you know, everybody starts, like, you know, getting their grooming down. And
well, I remember when gas was at its worst here, it was, what, about $4.50 a gallon?
Yeah.
I was working in L.A. a little bit during that time, and you would pass places like Paramount Studios, for instance, is one of the worst examples. There's one or two gas stations just outside the studios. They know the people coming out of Paramount don't care at all what the price of gasoline is. It's a convenience factor. They can get out of work, go get gas, and go home. So when it was $4.50 here, it was $5.70 there.
Oh.
You paid for the convenience.
Well, when I went to Aripex in Arizona, we would get close to the California line and we would not fill up our tank until we hit Arizona, because we knew in Arizona it would be easily 50 cents a gallon less. And it was. It was 50 cents a gallon less just by crossing over the border. And then, of course, when you're leaving Arizona, they have one gas station right on the California border. And it's like they advertise last chance to fill up. So you fill up there and then you drive across the border and you increase your net wealth by 50 cents a gallon.
Awesome.
So do we have anything else we want to add to this topic? What books do you have on the topic?
Well, I have the Counterfeit Kansas Basket Overprints, which is mentioned by John Hotchner. I have the 1927 to 32 book that's also mentioned by him. And I also have the U.S. Definitive Series by Martin Armstrong, which he didn't mention. All three of those have information on Kansas Basket Overprints. This isn't it.
Yeah, I would love to see some contemporary writings from some of the postal people.
I bet you I can find something in Pat Paragraphs.
Yeah, there you go. I wonder if he said, are you guys serious? Do you really think this will work?
Well, John did a really good job. We should make sure we post this article at our website because he has a section in here called Kansas-Nebraska Expertizing, which is an excellent summarization of the basic key points to check all your Kansas-Nebraska stamps. He did a good job laying out some of the rules.
Make sure we get permission from Linz to post it.
Oh, true.
You can put a link to it. We're not going to post it.
Why don't we just say, hey, Linz, we're referring people to your newspaper. Do you really want to stop us?
Email Chad.
Yeah. Send him a letter with a $1 stamp on it.
Mm. There you go. Oh, yeah. He'd appreciate that, actually.
Yeah.
So if you want to get in the market for these, he actually recommends that you get a certificate of some kind to go with that stamp of authenticity.
Just to be sure.
Instead of shooting in the dark and hoping it's real.
I agree.
Well, on the high values, yeah.
How often, like, what's the percentage of real versus fakes out there?
Well, the APS handbook says that upwards of 60% of the used copies are fakes.
Whoa.
But wow. And I would assume that it's much less on the mint stamps simply because it's so much easier to tell.
Could you theoretically use a typewriter on a used stamp and then soak it for an hour to get some of the ridges out and then press it out and
probably
make a better fake?
Yeah, probably.
So I could see how that'd be harder.
Yeah, but then the ink's on top of the cancel.
That's true. Yeah, not everybody has a 40x stereoscope to check to see what order the ink is layered into.
Okay, you guys want to open the C3A?
You mean the... I am still hoping that eventually we find one.
You mean the 4806.
There you go.
4806. The C3A-ish.
The C3A reprint?
Ooh, I have a good feeling about this one.
I feel it's going to be postage.
Postage!
Aww. Poo.
Okay, so you can email us at stampshowhereday@gmail.com. Twitter at StampShowHT, Facebook, StampShowHereToday.com, and for your questions and comments, you can also call us at a Google Voice answering machine anytime. The number is 949-873-4298. There's also a link to the Google Voice on our website so you can call from any computer. And on that note, keep collecting.
This is Gregory Slaughter from Esper, and I'm listening to the Stamp Show Here Today.
This episode of Stamp Show Here Today is brought to you by the Philatelic Book of Secrets, the book that teaches you about repurfs, regums, color varieties, and much more. Get yours for $10 at www.philatelicsecrets.com today.